Out there for brands and consumers. VIPs or video innovation trendsetters are roaming the streets, watching niche content on their smartphones, going home and plugging in their Chromecast. We take a look at what content they are consuming, where do they consume it in this week's content special. This is the PhD Cast from PhD Australia. Hi there, this is the PhD Cast. My name is Christian from PhD Australia, and today I'm sitting with a bunch of awesome people. PhD Cast regulars, Lauren.
Hello.
Emma.
Hi.
Jess.
Hello.
And a special guest today, Angela Rapley.
Hello.
How are you, Angela? It's been a while.
It's been a while. Not for any particular reason, but just because it's been so crazy, but I'm so glad to be with you here today. Content.
Exactly, because today we're going to talk content, but before we're going to talk content, actually, this is a really special day. It's the 22nd of May, so a really huge shout out and a happy birthday to Chris Stevenson.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday, Chris, and yeah, if you have been listening, and if you bear with us at the end, you're in for a treat, a musical specialty at the very end of PhD Cast.
Excellent. There's also another little thing that we should mention that is happening this weekend.
The lovely intimate baby.
Betrothed, getting married, walking down the aisle.
Exactly. So in advance, congrats, Nicola. Just give you the heads up. Have a great day. Just say yes.
Don't forget his name at the aisle. All will be well.
Yeah, so today, as Angela mentioned already, we are going to talk content, and we'll be doing it in the context of a report that we just lately got hold of, which is the Curve Report. The Curve Report is NBC Universal Content Innovation Agency's research, basically, about content now, content in the future, what's yet to come, and we bumped into it through PSFK. One of the really interesting articles was about what's yet to come, who are actually defining the future of content, or at least the future of the platforms where content is sitting at.
Okay, so the report looked into a group of people that they call video innovation trendsetters.
Or VITs.
VITs, indeed. Which is a sort of select group of what it was called pioneers, or certainly sort of early adopters, in all things like digital and content consumption, and they represented about 14% of the general population. This was done in the US, I should point out, but still sort of very valid.
It's quite a significant proportion of the population, actually.
So these are people that will be the first to experiment with new platforms. They're very much leaders in deciding, okay, what's really going to perhaps take off, and what are the mainstream population going to use. Things like sort of Vine or Kickstarter were sort of, I guess, come up through these kind of people. I think one of the stats that stuck out to me, which was actually sort of a surprise, was the high number, and I think it's here, 57%, that would pay for an educational lecture or a course, and this idea of people being quite happy and wanting to find content and pay for that content about learning a new skill. So I think we talk a lot about this audience in terms of entertainment, find very sort of disposable content, the funniest new video. But so that sort of struck me as being quite an interesting thing around learning and new skills.
So would you think that this audience of VITs that we talk about is kind of, sorry, this audience of VITs is kind of a subset of a Gen Y early adopter group, so it's a subset of that. And do you think that means that they like the, instead of the cats on skateboard type content that we all use as a kind of a way of defining that type voice. They're actually, there's a little bit more substance to it, and they're wanting to
absolutely, yeah,
learn a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think perhaps we might traditionally think, oh, they want to find, you know, the latest funny video, but actually they want to be more authoritative in other areas in terms of finding great content and being the first to learn about new skills as well. And this behaviour of using digital platforms to find content, to share content, actually applies to all walks of their life, not just kind of from an entertainment standpoint.
I wonder, are the universities cottoning on to that? And I'm sure they are in some way, developing courses or...
already, loads of courses actually online, like...
sure there are media courses, there have been media courses around for donkeys, but I'm wondering, is it specific, are there going to be now university Vine courses, or whatever the latest platform is?
Those specific, social media or new emerging platforms, I don't think that they're doing that just yet, but... There's Harvard and Stanford webcasts and stuff that you can go on and do courses for free, actually, that are provided by the universities.
Do you have the imprimatur of Harvard if you do one of their courses? Can you put that on your CV?
I don't think you can put that. You've got a diploma.
But you can't buy from Harvard. That's something I would pay good money for.
I think you can at the very least, say that you've taken X course at Harvard.
But at the same time, also, I've actually heard that many of these, and I've seen myself that many of these courses offer you some kind of diploma. Most probably, it's not going to be a Harvard diploma, but for an extra bit of money, you can get some kind of certificate that you actually completed a test at the end of it. So, yes, it's already going on.
I'm a little bit cynical as to, a lot of these articles that you read, the ones we've read for this session, and also that you read in general, talk about how this group, whether they're called VRTs or something else, dictate the content and the development of content on, even within existing channel networks. And I'm always a little bit cynical as to whether we big up the power of this group. I certainly think that they have a lot of influence in terms of, people being able to ascertain what's popular, what's trending, what characters that people like, etc. But I'm not quite sure if it would literally dictate, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, but it would literally dictate the type of content being made. Have we seen examples of whether because of Twitter feeds or because of Twitter mentions, something has been developed off the back of it, bespoke?
Well, I don't know if it has an influence in developing the content necessarily, but one of the articles that's in this report talked about a social video service called Telly. They actually already have 15 million monthly users. You sign in with Facebook, and then all of your friends get to see what videos you're watching. So it allows you to pull instead of kind of self-discovery, it's more of
curation,
discovery of what's kind of popular amongst your friends. And I think from that perspective, I think it's interesting to how that influences what you see, rather than from that could then ultimately influence how content's made and what content's made, because one of the things I noticed when I have visited LA a couple of times, the news was covering celebrity things that were happening. I said, that's not a mainstream news thing. That's TMZ's area, not
the Kardashian wedding, etc.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's quite interesting to see, what users are consuming is influencing content.
I think it has a real impact on the news agenda, and I think you can see that the Arab Spring and all these different political events that were absolutely almost dictated to by what was happening in Twitter sphere. But I'm just interested to see how it pans out with regard to actual content that is made. And I want to differentiate between, we talk a lot about, there's this whole argument or debate about the death of television and does social content and does this video content and does YouTube signal the death knell to television or whatever. And I think it's kind of a moot point these days, because I think quite a few years ago, television executives who traditionally made content for the networks cottoned on to this whole internet thing and began thinking outside the box. Some do it to a greater extent than others, but now it's kind of what somebody I heard a guy at one of the umbrella conferences talking about any vision. So they're not strictly thinking of this is something that I will make for telly. They're saying this is a piece of great content. It will live where it needs to live, and in making this great content, it'll probably live everywhere. But I don't think anybody specifically thinks that I'm going to make great content just for television anymore, because they're so aware the fact that their audiences have migrated, gone away from television, they're on these different platforms, they're aggregating content from lots of different spaces and places. So
there was a really nice quote actually in one of the other articles which I think we're about to go on to, that's kind of talked about sort of content being like great stories, and that they survive and thrive across any platform development, or they live across any platform that survived the changes as well, which I thought was really good. And not talking about how do you define television, but how do we define content being a real question here as well.
I think it's really interesting as part of that same article, like some extended information that they had with some quotes from people around, of course, the US, where they did the research, and what they said about TV and what they defined TV as. And one of the ones I loved was, for me, TV is the show. It no longer just means sequences shown on a television set. It refers to television-style content, and it definitely includes the internet. So there's a couple other ones about TV sounds archaic, people stream and download now, but mostly it is about TV doesn't mean sitting in front of a television set. If you say, I'm watching TV, it's not that you...
I'm in the living room,
yeah,
watching the box in the corner.
So it could be TV as the content, and then there's a couple other things that say, you know, I'm watching TV, but I'm physically watching the television set in my living room, but I've got a whole bunch of different types of media that's coming into it. Like, I've got a Chromecast, I've got an Apple TV, I've got just IPTV in general connected to your TV. So all the different ways you're getting TV is not a broadcast signal just necessarily.
But even if you are still watching the traditional box, which a lot of people still do, mm-hmm. and I'm going to give away a dirty secret here, I'm obsessed with The Voice, and I watch it. I watch it with my Twitter feed, and I can't. My husband always tells me to either watch one or the other because he can't multitask and he can't do both. But I literally sit there, up and down, reading the tweets,
it makes it
so
program.
Much better.
Yeah, it's more entertaining to see what people are talking about alongside the TV show that you're watching.
I spend half the time looking at what people are tweeting and laughing at that, and then also comparing to what I did.
Context, and see what's happening on the screen. So yeah.
The Jeffrey Katzenberg from DreamWorks gave some, he was at MIP, the content conference in Cannes last year, and he said that actually the golden age of TV is now. And that sounds really kind of counterintuitive given all the stuff that we're talking about, but what he's saying is, you know, it's a great time to be a content producer now, because you've got this plethora of other platforms that you can now make content for. You don't have to be so narrowly defined, and you know, the little players can have a say as well in what's going on.
And at the same time, there was some really interesting stats as well in one of the articles that was saying that whilst, yes, it's really important, especially for Gen Xers and Gen Buyers, that they want to consume content that's kind of niche, that they feel it's content for me, it's actually about like 64%. At the same time, 60% of 18 to 49 years old say they miss the days when everyone watched and talked about the same TV shows, in which actually social is playing an increasingly important role.
So anyway, there was a part of the report that I found particularly interesting, which looked at why TV should look to Twitter for inspiration, which is all about how users are engaging on Twitter and talking about television shows. Perfect example of that is The Voice or MKR, for all the Australians listening. And basically the article was about the impact that social media has on the type of content that is being produced and how social media can drive engagement in these programs, but also how something like Twitter can be used as a sort of measurement of success. So there's an example of Sharknado. If anyone remembers that movie, there's
another one coming out
soon. So at its peak, Sharknado generated discussion at the rate of 5,000 tweets per minute. So I think it's huge.
A huge number of people to watch that would never have seen it before because it just took off and
And now there's another one coming out. So it shows that sort of the power that social media does have in driving engagement and awareness.
Yeah, so we're all in for a treat as of July 2014 because Sharknado, the second episode is coming up. And it's called Sharknado 2, the second one. Literally, it's amazing.
I can't
wait. Yeah, I would actually going back to the earlier conversation or the earlier question that you posed to, as of to what extent actually Twitter and the conversations are actually influencing.
That's
so
a great
context.
example of
how something completely new springs to life.
And in what's soon to be coming to Australia and what's been over in the US is the Twitter TV ratings. So not only are we able to listen to that conversation in terms of to drive eyeballs there, to measure or drive engagement, to perhaps even define how a show storyline develops, because we've also seen examples of that where people use social conversation to decide, all that kind of stuff. But I think the TV rating seems really great because it's more of a sort of more formalised measurement around TV engagement. So looking at everybody that's tweeted about a certain show and offering sort of demographic data and interest data and all that kind of thing about who these people are.
And they're now able to identify the age and gender of those tweeting as well. So that's going to provide huge insight to brands or...
But it's also more accurate because it's not fair to just look at the old school kind of Barb ratings in the UK or whatever just to determine who's watching what. We now have to aggregate all these people across all these different platforms, and that gives a true and plus the DVR stuff, the time shifted stuff, and counting that in with your numbers as well is really important.
So as I was saying, for the last couple of years, they're sort of counting the time shifting stuff. I think it's interesting what they're doing with the Twitter TV ratings, because they did say in terms of the methodology, because Twitter doesn't actually ask you for any demographic information. It's actually all modeled information, or mostly modeled information. And so there is a lot of, I guess, generic guessing. So I wouldn't say it's exactly this audience, but it's definitely a great way to add on to the traditional ratings platform to kind of look at engagement with a show or passion around a show. Because I feel like there's probably some shows that lend itself better to a lot of social media chatter than other ones, but it doesn't mean that the other shows don't have the audience or don't have, I guess, a loyal fan base.
Yeah,
it's just additional layer, especially if that's something that a marketer is looking for in terms of engagement. And it would be interesting if there's any sort of research, whether it's currently there or someone can do it, about looking at brand lifts between shows that are highly engaged with Twitter TV ratings and shows that don't necessarily have as much chatter. Like, are people
more
impacted by the marketing messages that happen in non-engagement shows or engagement shows? And I mean, stuff that we've seen from Neuro Insights recently talked about the integration of marketers with some key pieces of content from around different shows that are on air. And so that kind of sponsorship or integration with a show, maybe not specifically part of the show, but kind of melding, might actually still be better than just a regular TVC.
And why are we actually talking about this when in the context of brands, why is content so important wherever it lives and however it's amplified? What does it have in for marketers and for agencies and definitely for brands?
I'm going to say something that's probably a little bit controversial, but I really do believe it. But I think content is important because people are not watching advertising in the same way that they used to. And I think everybody knows that. And that's why there's been a proliferation of digital media and all these other types of media, because people generally go, if they're watching a television program, they're going out to make the tea when the ads are on, and advertisers have to find different ways of talking to their consumers. And no longer do they want to be wrapped around the programming in the old traditional sense. They want to be part of the entertainment. And that's kind of what people like me in my role as a director of content, or anybody in the content space, is trying to do, to get more advertisers to spend money in creating great, awesome, engaging, compelling content that happens to have brand messaging throughout and adheres to kind of the same brand values, and there's a great equity fit between the content and the brand. But what I'm really passionate about is, and I think some brands do it really well and some others not as well, is, you know, branded content does not mean a half-hour ad. It's not advertorial. It's not literally a 30-second ad dragged into or expanded into a program. Really good branded content mightn't have a huge amount of product placement, and it mightn't have a huge amount of branding, but it has the essence of the brand throughout, especially when it's been created for the brand, like bespoke branded content. Too many advertisers I've seen just think that, great, I'm going to get into branded content because that's the buzzword and everybody's talking about it, and I will find ways of shoehorning my brand in as much as possible into this content, especially in Asia where I worked, whereby if I was working with a hair brand, they would think that we had to have shots of people washing their hair, you know, in every scene. And I'm just saying, it's so counterproductive for us to be involved in this world of entertainment, brand of entertainment, if you insist on doing this, because people will just run in droves from this content. We have to do it cleverly, we have to do it organically. And I think that's always been my message. It's really hard to do well, and I think that that's our biggest challenge as media practitioners, to do it well for our clients.
Arguably, storytelling is hugely important, and storytelling partly comes of the quality of actually how you bring it to life. And just recently, seen a really interesting research. Actually, did an interesting research. I don't know if there is this show on National Geographic. I think it's called Mind Games. It's basically narrated, I think, by Jason Silva, and they were talking a lot about long and short-term memory, because obviously this is what we are always fighting for. We had lots of neuroscience discussions as well around this area lately, and we know that whenever we are making connections between brands and certain associations, we ignite different neurons in our brains, and what was really interesting in this program as well, that they highlighted the fact how important it is that we make these connections meaningful, because it will help us actually hardwire these connections, these associations into our brains, and they argued as well that one of the easiest, or not easiest, but one of the perfect ways to go around it is to create amazing stories around it. And what they did is
because they have greater resonance.
Greater resonance, and for you as well as a consumer or a viewer, it's easier to put it into a context. So what they did, they showed you, for instance, within the program, they showed you 9 different objects, right? And shorter memory, and normally your memories are actually not able to tackle more than 5 to 7 objects at the same time. So you needed to focus on these objects and then try yourself how much you can actually remember. And then a minute later, what they did, they created a story around exactly the same object. So you could measure it against yourself how much you remember it better. And that was just an insane cool selling point for me as well, that yes, actually I remember it much better. And they also interviewed like a memory champion from the US, because there's such thing as a memory champion,
yeah,
and
yeah.
He also said that he always creates associations,
yeah,
and creates,
yeah,
stories, because it makes it easier to,
yeah,
understand.
An example of that, I guess, and this was sort of born out of TDC really, but an example of that is the sort of the John Lewis Christmas ads, because it's building that association. It's kind of telling a story that everybody,
warm, fuzzy,
can associate to. It's quite emotive in terms of the music they use as well. So I mean, there's one of the tracks that they use now that whenever I hear that, I just think of that ad, and it's making those associations as well. I think it's kind of similar to sort of
It's clever. That was a really clever piece of advertising, and
yeah,
some brands do it. I think Red Bull does. I've said this before, but Red Bull does content brilliantly, and they managed to create that niche that they are the kind of extreme sports brand. And you would never, you know, initially they were just a sugar and water drink, but now they are the extreme sports brand and the sport brand. So I think it's a really interesting, and there's probably far more to talk about than we have time for, but. It's I love, and I really respect kind of savvy marketeers and savvy brand clients who understand that if they want to get into this brand new world of content, there are different rules of engagement, different rules to play by. It's not traditional advertising, and they have to be a little bit more clever, possibly more subtle, but just do it seamlessly and organically and cleverly. And that's the key challenge. It's easier said than done, I think.
But awesome, awesome words to finish on. This is all that we have time in today's PhD cast. So let's shout out a collective goodbye to everyone listening, guys. Goodbye! Next week, we're going to have Chris Stevens on back again. So next week, definitely as well, we're going to have PhD cast in regular time. So bear with us and see you in 168 hours. La 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 la.
To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or find us on Google Plus @PhD Australia.